Fans would come to me and say, "Why were you so mean?" And I'd say, "Look, I wasn't mean. I was trying to save the Federation." Picard was like, you know, Mr. Softy and humane, and that was important, not soft, but, you know, always taking the humane side. And I had to represent, you know, the principal that would not, you know, let the Borg get away with anything, for example. You don't want a character to be one-dimensional. You know, she's a tough broad, you know, goes so far. It's more interesting, but she had to do it, you know, and that's what Admiral and higher generals, I guess, and up the ladder have to make those hard decisions. Hi, I'm Natalia Nogalich. I played Admiral Nechayev on Star Trek Next Generation and on DS9. And I'm happy to be here today on Trek Untold.
Welcome to Trek Untold, the Star Trek podcast that goes beyond the stars. I am your host, Matthew Kaplowitz. Starfleet Brass has an unenviable role of upholding the laws and standards of the Federation, and that often means being at odds with our favorite captains. Today's guest on this podcast is one of those characters whose position on the food chain meant taking no prisoners when it came to enforcing the rules, but there is more than meets the eye to her character besides her attitude. Natalia Nogalich played Admiral Nechayev, a no-nonsense, high-ranking Starfleet official across two different series, beginning first in Star Trek The Next Generation in Chain of Command Part 1, followed by appearances in Descent, Journey's End, and Preemptive Strike. Following her time on TNG, she showed up in DS9 in the episodes The Maquis and The Search, once again reprising the same character. Admiral Nechayev dressed down Commander Riker, sipped tea with Picard, and made Commander Sisko's life a whole lot harder on his space station. Chances are you've also seen Natalia in some of her other roles, which date as far back as the late 70s. She's been in things like Cagney and Lacey, Designing Women, Tales from the Crypt, Father Dowling Mysteries, Murder, She Wrote, Picket Fences, Frasier, Home Improvement, Caroline in the City, Criminal Minds, more recently Fuller House, and many, many more shows and films. Despite Natalia playing such forceful and sometimes foul characters on film and TV, she's nothing like that in real life, and is easily one of the nicest people you can possibly chat with. If you're in the New York area this summer, she'll be appearing at Trek Long Island 2 from May 31st to June 2nd, so you can meet her in person and find out for yourself. So let's put on our finest dress uniform and rise for the Admiral as we spend some time getting to know Natalia Nogalich. But before we start our chat with this week's guest, I want to remind you to please follow Trek Untold on social media, including Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. You can find this show on all of those platforms simply by searching for Trek Untold. Make sure you subscribe to this show, whether that's on the audio platform of your choosing or on YouTube, where the video version of this show lives. And speaking of, make sure to check out our YouTube channel more frequently for episodes of our new mini show, Tales from Trek Untold, as well as other sci-fi goodies. And of course, don't forget to leave ratings, reviews, comments, and whatever you can do, no matter what platform you're on, to enjoy this podcast and show others that you're digging it too. If you want to support this show financially, please consider becoming a Patreon member at patreon.com/trekuntold. Shout out to Trek Long Island, who is having their second annual convention this summer at Hop Hog Long Island, New York, from May 31st to June 2nd. Headlined by Melissa Navia from Strange New Worlds, Armin Shimerman, Chase Masterson, and J.G. Hertzler from DS9, Ethan Phillips from Star Trek Voyager, and Gabriel Ruiz from Lower Decks. Among many other modern and classic Trek shows, this three-day event will feature autographs, panels, including some with yours truly, and other ways for you to hang out with the stars and meet your fellow fans. You can learn more about this event or buy tickets for it at treklongisland.com. Now, without further ado, let's go ahead and beam in this week's guest. Computer, access interview file. And joining me on the other side of the screen right now, I wish I had the proper boson whistle from the Navy, because we have an admiral on deck today. We're joined today by Natalia Nogalich. Natalia, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so happy to finally meet you directly, Matthew.
Likewise, you know, I've been saying, like, you're one of those names on my big list of Star Trek folks talk to since like day one. So this really is a dream come true. It's so exciting to be first staring at you virtually across the screen. I'm going to try and not get all the goosebumps, but this feels like a big one for me.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored. Thank you so much.
So we got a lot to cover today, but I kind of want to start with just kind of seeing a little bit of your background. And I want to start with Natalia. What's your earliest memory of Star Trek? Did you grow up as a fan?
Oh, wow. I have to be honest, I wasn't a huge follower, but I do remember watching, obviously, the original series with my family. And my sister was really an avid fan of the original series. I liked it. You know, I wasn't as crazy about it as I am now that I participated in it and gone back and watched everything and met the people. It I've certainly, it's gotten inside me in a different way.
And I got to say, I've spoken to a lot of fans who have met you at conventions. And I do just want to right now up front, before we even get any further, just thank you for like how great you are with the fans. Like, everybody has said such great things about you. I'm excited to meet you coming up later this summer at Trek Long Island 2. I've really heard just like amazing things about you. So yeah, the bar has been set high, Natalia.
thank you, Matthew. I'll tell you, I enjoy the convention so much. I enjoy meeting the fans. I don't consider it labor at all. And I spend a lot of time talking to them. And sometimes it annoys some of the people that are behind them waiting to get, you know, because I'll get all involved with how they are doing. I've also had some fun times with fans coming up to me and saying, well, what? You're so nice. And you were such a B-I-T-C-H to poor Captain Picard. And here you are now, which is the real you? And I go, this is the real me. I was playing a role and the Admiral had to keep him in line. And I had to kind of explain, you know, that there's this thing called acting there. I'm not necessarily that person. But yeah, I've had a wonderful time with fans and I've had made a lot of friends that, you know, I've stayed in touch with and that, you know, maybe not email. Well, yeah, some of them email me if they have a way to get in touch with me or, yeah, or I see them on an iMessage or something. It's a great thing. I've loved every one of them and I'm happy to be doing this one coming up on Long Island.
Yeah, I just love how much you've embraced the fandom and the fans. That's just really cool. So let's kind of get into the secret origin story of Natalia. I'd like to know where you grew up, who your parents were and what they did, and what did little Natalia want to be when she grew up?
Okay, this will be fun. I grew up in Chicago, in the city. I come from humble beginnings. My dad was a construction worker, and then later he became a letter carrier. And my mom was a mom. And a short time, she worked in a bakery and then in a factory when they bought a house and a little extra money was needed. But she was pretty much an at-home mom. She emigrated from Serbia. Then it was Yugoslavia. My dad has that same ancestry, but he was born in Chicago. She immigrated legally, by the way, just FYI. Her father, my grandfather, had come before he had a family, was sponsored by somebody and enlisted in World War I and received the Congressional Medal of Honor and many, 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 many other medals from all the Allied countries. And he was a big war hero. And then he went back to Serbia and met my grandmother. And then he brought his kids over, you know, at the right time. So that was, that's my ancestry story. I've been there many times. I still feel a real closeness to that heritage. Obviously, my grandparents are long gone, but I did know them. I did have the privilege of knowing my war hero granddad on my mom's side, and then also my other grandfather who on my dad's side, who was a great guy too. And then my dad also fought in World War II and landed in Normandy. And he was a Purple Heart Bronze Star Presidential Citation guy, very, very humble. Just, you know, rarely spoke about it until toward the end. He died at 102. And while I was caring for him, he started telling me some of the stories that he'd kept close to his chest for so many years, as many of those guys did.
It's the silent generation.
It's not for nothing that they are the silent and greatest generation, in my view, still. We'll see how we turn out, or me, you're younger than I am. But So, so I grew up in Chicago and we lived in a, you know, I have an older sister and a younger brother. My sister's recently gone to heaven, and my younger brother and I are still close, but we were a very tight family, very loving, very, you know, kind of church going and, you know, just close to our cousins and, you know, the whole sort of European immigrant experience to a great extent. And when I was 9, we moved into a house, which we had been living in an apartment on a busy street. So this was like really great. We had a backyard and my mom had a garden and it was a better school district and all that. When I was very little, when we were still in the first apartment, I had dancing aspirations, and my parents took me to ballet school and my sister to tap at the local park district community. And I have pictures of me, I don't know, 4 years old, 5 years old, standing on the coffee table and with the pirouette and an arabesque. And I did pursue that. That's maybe a story for later on. And then I, at the same community place, they enrolled us, my sister and I, in drama lessons, which I also adored. And we did plays together. And it really kind of bit me early. My brother was all into sports, so it was mostly my sister and I into these other things. But I'll just skip ahead and say that was something my parents encouraged as hobby and good for you to learn expression and so on. Never did they want their daughter to be an actress. That is not, I don't know if that's any immigrant's dream. Oh yeah, I want my daughter to be an actress, you know, and out of work half her life or whatever, you know. But that's the way it turned out. And that kind of had a circuitous route for me. But anyway, I was lucky. I had a loving home. Really lucky. I know that's not true for a lot of folks. And so I feel blessed to have had that. Yeah. We didn't have a lot of money. You know, we didn't go on a lot of vacations, maybe up to Wisconsin or something. But I don't know. It was a really precious and joyful time. So I'm grateful.
So you started out as a dancer. You got bit by the acting bug. So how do you come along to get your very first professional on-screen gig?
On-screen. Well, my sister did not get bit by the acting bug, because she became a producer and a director. Ah. And she, yeah, very successful, very brilliant at her work. She worked in commercials and short films, and then she got hired as a co-producer and casting person in a feature film that was directed by Andrew Davis, the guy who did Fugitive and a lot of other big movies. He's most known for that. And he's a Chicago guy. And his first movie was called Stony Island. And it was about a bunch of musicians on the south side of Chicago, et cetera, et cetera. My sister happened to be working as his assistant and also as the casting person. And she got me in to meet with him for a particular role. And of course, he didn't dare go against my sister. So I have to say, I was kind of ushered in to my first film part by my sister, and the kind of loyalty that Chicago directors had to other Chicago actors. At that time, I was working in a theater company, but I hadn't done any film until Stony Island. And I played the director's father's young mistress, which was fun. It's a good movie. I mean, he's made, you know, bigger movies since then, but I owe my break-in for Scream to my sister. Before that, I was all about theater and dance. I was in a theater company here in Chicago, which W.H. Macy and David Mamet founded. And the first job I had in it, I was hired as an actress, but it happened to have a dance routine. And they asked me to choreograph the dance routine, and which I did. And it was a lot of fun. And we stopped the show on opening night. And that was really exciting. However, at that time, I was working with a dance company, and they had a concert the same night as my play was going to open. And I had to choose. And that was hard, because dance was really my first love. But, you know, a kind of logic kicked in and I thought, well, how long could my career be as a dancer? I mean, let's face it, even if you excel in ballet, which is what I was more devoted to, I did some modern dance. It's over in your early 20s. I mean, of course you teach, but you can act until you're 90 and or more. Vanessa Redgrave, one of my heroes. So that's what made me choose the play. And I had to pull out of the dance concert, which was hard to do, but that was a real, you know, fork in the road. And I'd started dedicating myself to the acting side. But I kept up dancing. I kept up taking classes through the years. I don't now. I probably should, but.
Well, same here. Yeah.
Movement, right?
Movement's always handy, I hear. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm curious, you know, because you were coming from a world of being on the stage. Now you're on screen for the first time. It's probably just like a whole new world for you.
Oh,
is there
yes.
something that you learned from that particular in front of the camera gig that, you know, surprised you and that maybe you held on to for the rest of your career?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you asked that because what happens in the course of the movie is the guy who I'm his mistress is an older man. He dies and I discover him. And so it's a very emotional scene. And I was worried about being able to come up with that emotion it's so much easier on stage because you've got the whole thing rolling and you're into it and there's no break, but here it's like hot, you know, okay, makeup or, oh, we're taking lunch. And then you got to go back and, you know, come up with it. So somebody is going to come to the door and I'm supposed to be in tears. And so I went to my teacher, W.H. Macy was my teacher then. Great actor, great person, wonderful. And I said, I don't know what to do. I mean, how do you produce tears on call, on film? I mean, just like that. And he was mostly a theater guy too, but he had done some film. And he said, you do like you do in real life. You try not to cry. And I will never forget that because, A, it's true. Most of the time, and I sadly recently know a lot about grief because I've had some losses in my family, as you know. And it's really true. You don't, I mean, in private is one thing, but when you're around other people, you do your best not to break down. And then, of course, you break down anyway. So he gave me that pearl that I stayed, that I kept in my treasure chest of lessons learned and even taught it to other actors down the line because actors always worry about that. How am I going to cry when I need to cry? You know, and the fact is, deep emotion often doesn't entail tears. It's something else, something deeper. Sometimes it includes tears, but it's intimidating when you get a script and she says, and she sobs, you know, and then you feel like, you know, but anyway, I don't think I'll have any trouble sobbing in any role anymore with what these last few years have been like for me. But anyway, that was something I learned. And yeah, and the other piece is just learning to keep your concentration and not go off and have a coffee and a donut in between takes, which is, you know, actors, oh, another breakfast burrito, please. I'll be in my trailer. I mean, it wasn't that way for me. I only had a few days work on this film, but it's a very dangerous thing. And later on, Arthur Penn directed me in something and his son became a director and he gave me a very good piece of advice. His name was Matthew Penn is.
Good name.
He said, yeah, amen. He said, don't leave the set. When you're on a break, don't go back to your trailer. Stay on the set in your chair or somewhere. Stay in the story. And it's very tempting to want to say, well, I mean, if you have to use the restroom or something, that's one thing, but to run back to your trailer, especially now, check your phone, blah, 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 you know. And that was very valuable counsel for me. And I don't anymore. I mean, when there's, you know, and people say, oh, come on, let's go for, you know, let's go get a coffee at craft service or whatever. So, no, you know, I think it pays off to stay within the reality of the film, of the story. That's me anyway. And there's another piece that goes along with that, which is, I'm trying to remember who told me. I think I read it in an interview that Isabella Rossellini gave about her mother, Ingrid Bergman, the great. And the advice was, if you're doing a role with a dialect, don't lose the dialect. Keep it. When you're in your trailer, when you're in the makeup room, when you're in between takes, don't go back into your own, you know, stay with it. It's another way to stay in the story, to stay inside that reality. So those are some things I've learned. And if I've gone on too long, you can just cut out whatever's not interesting.
This is all great stuff. Don't you worry about that. This is my kind of show. I like getting into this nitty gritty.
Okay.
And,
good.
You know, it's perfect timing because, you know, a lot of your career, I noticed, was done with a lot of dialects, a lot of different accents, that kind of thing. And that brings me to a few other things I want to talk about non-Trek today. And let's start with maybe a French dialect, because you did Murder, She Wrote in the final season. Your episode was Murder à la Mode. Brilliant name, by the way. What a great name.
Wasn't that good?
Yeah. And spoiler alert, you were the murderer that week. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, talk to me about that. I'd love to hear any stories you have about working with Angela Lansbury. And in this case, too, having your dialect and making sure that you stay in that and not, you know, go all over the place and start doing different languages, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you that was one of my favorite shows to do, by the way, Murder, She Wrote. And it was the last season. And so by that time, the whole show ran like clockwork. It was all so smooth. They didn't call you in too early. You got in just at the right time. You know, a lot of times you get in and you're sitting and wait. It was all beautiful. You know, Angela Lansbury was one of the executive producers, but all of it was just, another hero of mine, was marvelous. So welcoming to the guest stars, you know, I mean, made me feel like I was, you know, part of the regular cast. I mean, just greeted me by name, shook my hand, welcome to the set, you know, just terrific. And I found through the years that the really great actors who have had amazing careers, especially those that started in theater, don't mind my saying, are very gracious and warm and understand what it's like to be a guest star and jump into a machine that's already well oiled. The French, early in my move to Los Angeles, I can tell you how that happened later if you want to know, I got cast in a play where I had to speak some French. Now, I'm a bit of a polyglot. I do speak Serbian. I studied Russian in college. I studied Spanish, and I studied in Madrid, and I also studied in Florence, Italy. So I had a few languages already, but never French. And so I get to L.A. and I get cast in this play called Tamara, and I have to speak in French. And so I heard about this woman who was from Paris who taught French. I hired her just to teach me phonetically the French that was on the page. I didn't expect to learn French, you know what I mean, that would in time for the opening. But I loved working with her so much that after I got those few lines, trying to remember some of the things. Je suis tellement fatiguée. I am so terribly tired. That was my first line in this. I just arrived from a trip from abroad. And anyway, so I continued working with her and learning French. And I still work with her maybe once a month by phone, just so I can practice French. And we became very good friends. And I'm godmother to her daughter and on and on and on. But it happened because I had... So... Cut to then years later, I had been working with Sylvie, my teacher in French. I get cast in Murder, She Wrote. You know, I could pretty much produce the French accent pretty well because, you know, I was speaking it with Sylvie all the time. But I called her and I said, just go over these lines with me so I'm doing an authentic. And she helped me. You know, the thing is, and this for all actors, you got to produce something like that. Hire an expert to help you. I did a Broadway show where I had to speak with a British dialect, and I could come up with that on my own, but I hired somebody to make sure it was done properly, because what do we have but words? And so that happened. And yeah, I was happy to be the one who was the murderer in that. That was more fun because I had done an earlier episode where I played a fortune teller, and I think I had a dialect for that too. I think it was some sort of Eastern European thing. Well, I was murdered and found at the bottom of a cistern, very unglamorous, and death. But so when they called me back, which I was surprised in a different role, and to be the, you know, the murderer is always more fun than being murdered.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear. I don't speak from life experience, but that's what I've heard.
Well, yeah. Let's hope not. We could, Matthew.
You know, I've always found it interesting, though, that people who can do like amazing accents and they can just fall into it. It's always kind of astounding to me, like how you just basically just started speaking French dialect all of a sudden out of nowhere. For actors who are kind of still learning how to get into that mm-hmm. dialect, mm-hmm. what do you recommend for them? I mean, like, I know if I'm trying to talk to somebody and I want to suddenly New York it up, I got to say a trigger word like coffee or something. But, what do you do to help kind of get things going when you're first starting?
Well, that's a good question. If I speak the language, and I did learn enough French, and I speak Italian and Spanish, so I can do those dialects, I do some words in the language, not with the dialect, but actually in the language. Like if I was going to do Italian, I would say some words first in Italian. So, non posso sopportare questa cosa qui, ma mangia tu fratello, ma cosa fai? I might do some words first, and then I would say, okay, all right now, what do you want me to do? To fix this, you stupid son of mine, mannage, you know, then you can carry it over. Now, everybody doesn't speak a lot of languages like I do. So the other tool we have is to listen, get a tape, get a movie, get an Italian movie, get a French movie, and just listen. Turn off the picture and just listen to it and start to get it in your head. I grew up bilingual. We spoke Serbian and English at home. And they say, I don't know if it's true, that if you grow up bilingual, it's much easier to learn another language and another language and another language. And that kind of makes sense because I think your mind and also your tongue is used to many sounds, not just the sound of English. And it's easier to gain more. So for actors that have to do that, you have to work on it. You really have to work on it. And because you want it to be authentic. So maybe you have to listen if you have the time, if you find out you're doing an Italian woman or man and you have the time, just inundate yourself with the sound of Italian. I like to do it in movies, but there are all kinds of apps now you can do, but I find them very kind of didactic. You know, I'd much rather listen to the Italian being spoken and get it in the rhythm. And much of a dialect has to do with rhythm. You know, the Italian has a very kind of musical rhythm. The French is more in the front of your mouth and you're always looking like they are going to kiss you, you know. The Serbian, I don't know what my daughter wants to do to be an actress. That's crazy. It's just a crazy thing for us. That's why I sent her to college? I don't think so. You know, that came very natural to me. Russian, I studied, is very similar to Serbian, but it's more in the back of your mouth, like, all right, Alexander, you keep trying to do the same thing over and over and over again, and it's not working. It's more kind of chewed. Each language has a place that it occurs in your mouth. I've coached people with dialects in the past, not a lot, but some, and I give them those kind of tips. It's fun. It's fun to be doing a different dialect. I mean, don't you have fun when you talk New York?
Oh, it's definitely fun. And I do have to admit, by the way, when you did your Italian voice, that just sounded like my friend's mom. That just scared the heck out of me. So, oh my goodness. No more of that one, please. Oh boy.
Yeah.
I thought I was in trouble.
I actually like the New York, I don't know that I lived in New York 6 years, but I don't think I ever really got the, you know, the talk or the Brooklyn or the, you know, but I love it. I love you can speak that way to me anytime. I think it's a very interesting dialect and very, it's catchy.
Yeah, you know? It has its moments. I mean, I don't like slipping into it. I try to fight it all the time, but there's certain words where I can't really help it. So it just happens.
Coffee, like you said.
Exactly. Yeah. I try not to, but I just got to have my coffee in the morning. Oh, I did it.
Yes. And it's in you, right? Because that's where you grew up. Yeah. See, that's what it is.
Well, it's funny, you know, because you've done a lot of roles like with the Slavic accent. And that kind of brings me to another role I want to talk about, which is more recent for you. And that was your recurring role in Fuller House on Netflix.
Oh, Berta.
Yes, Berta.
I love Berta. Oh, my goodness. Yes, she was a Russian a person who had a bridal salon. And Berta, well, I don't know if she was exactly Russian or Eastern European. I don't know if they identified.
But some kind of anonymous Eastern European.
Kind of
character.
Eastern European, you know, Berta. And so much of what I did with Berta was kind of combination of Russian and Polish and Serbian, you know, because I thought, you know, they didn't identify where in Eastern Europe she was from. But it was so good for the character because the Slavic, they're so expressive. You know, and she was so, you know, dictatorial and authoritarian, you know, don't do that. Sit here. Don't hear. I'm on break smoking. Leave me alone. Berta, you know, she was just perfect to be an Eastern European. And I have actually some kids in the church I go to. Their father said, my kids just love Berta. They just keep playing the reruns of Fuller House because they like Berta. And then they, you know, then they met Berta, me. And yeah, you know, and that brings me to, I really like comedy. I like the, I've done probably more drama than comedy in my career, but that sitcom in front of an audience, I love that stuff. I mean, that's just like theater for me, because even though you rehearse it and they can edit if something goes wrong, oops, boom, we're going to go back and do it again. You don't have that luxury on stage, but the fact that you're doing it in front of a live audience, I loved it. And those people, Fuller House, oh my God, what a wonderful cast. I mean, they were really united and terrific. I enjoyed that. I was glad to go back a few times as Berta. I kept giving them ideas of when we were there. I would say to them, you know, Berta could come back and maybe, you know, become a teacher or something. You know, I thought, tried to insinuate myself into more episodes, but that was actually, I think that was there towards the end of their run.
Yeah, you were there season three, and then you came back twice in five. Yeah, yeah. So that was towards the end, yeah.
And then that was towards the end, yeah. They were hoping for more, and I was there the day they found out they weren't going to get more, and that was disappointing to them who have been doing it for a long time. I mean, for me, it's, you know, kind of like, okay, on to the next one.
Attention all Starfleet personnel. New York's only fan-run Star Trek convention, Trek Long Island, is back this summer. Get ready for 3 days of sci-fi fun celebrating your favorite franchise in the Empire State. Meet the stars from Trek shows spanning different eras, including Melissa Navia and Yatidi Padaki from Strange New Worlds, Gabriel Ruiz from Lower Decks, Armin Shimerman, Chase Masterson, J.G. Hertzler, and Kitty Swink from DS9, Ethan Phillips from Voyager, Janet Kidder, Tara Rosling, Conrad Coates, and Elias Defexis from Discovery, and many more, including celebrities who haven't been at a Star Trek convention in years, like Clyde Kasatsu, Natalia Nogalich, and Daphne Ashbrook. Come meet your fellow fans. Take in a panel with your favorite podcasters. Enjoy dinner with the stars, featuring live musical performances. Meet authors, artists, and musicians, and so many more during this epic 3-day event brought to you by the talented and inclusive community that makes Star Trek go at warp speed. Trek Long Island takes place from May 31st to June 2nd at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Hauppauge, New York. Visit treklongisland.com for tickets, exclusive packages, and more information. Trek Long Island, going kindly this summer.
Your career has been a lot of basically jumping from comedy to drama, and that's a lot of actors out there too. It's very much that. But you know, you kind of said something that was interesting too, and I don't know if you agree with this point or not, but it feels like, you know, a lot of folks consider drama to be the high art, the be all and end all of performing. Whereas to be a great comedic actor, it requires a lot of skills that you don't just necessarily have in the same way you get the dramatic skills. I mean, I don't want to say one is harder than the other, but it does feel like comedy doesn't quite get as appreciated as drama does.
You are so right. It does not get as appreciated, and it is much harder, in my view. There's a story of an actor in the 19th century, Edmund Kean, I think his name was, and he, the story goes, I don't know if this is true or not, he was dying, and somebody came up to him, and they said, you're a great actor. How will we go on without you, you know, dying? He said, apparently, he said on his dying bed, dying is easy. Comedy is hard. And, you know, it is. Because the thing for something to succeed, in my view, in comedy, is you have to create the reality of it. You can't just, you know, go for the joke or go for the punchline. You have to create the reality of the situation and actually play it with high stakes, and that's what makes it funny. Mm. You know, it's I mean, you take like an old sitcom that is still highly regarded, The Honeymooners, you know, Ralph, you know, Jackie Gleason. And it, I mean, he was very serious about his demand to be the king of the castle and keep his wife under his thumb and all that. And she, but he went to such high stakes about it and would get so angry if things weren't working his way that you burst out laughing because he was so extreme. The stakes were so high. If she didn't obey, you know, a simple thing like where she put the potatoes or something, and he'd go off on it. That's one of the qualities of comedy, is you have to have high stakes and you have to be real. And I always, this is going to sound silly, but you have to hit your consonants. Cat isn't funny. Cat can be funny. And that's more true in comedy than drama. You have to, it has to kind of spark off the stage or the screen. And you'll notice if you watch comedians, they hit their final consonants very, very well. But yes, I think what you said is true. It's much harder. People think drama's harder. Drama's not easy. Also, you have to create the reality and so on. But I think many talented comedians can do drama. I don't know that many great dramatic actors could do comedy. Mm. I mean, I would totally buy Steve Martin in a drama. I totally would.
Yeah, he's amazing and only murders.
Yeah, and I have, you know, and oh, there are others. They're not coming to me at the moment, but yeah, comedy is much more difficult. I have such admiration for people who do stand up. I mean, I don't know how they do that. How can you stand up there and die or not? You know, I saw a clip on my iPhone of Rodney Dangerfield. It was like 4 minutes. It was so brilliant. I mean, there were so many jokes, so many laughs in that short time. And I was thinking, how long did it take him to learn that, to create it, to write it, learn it, and do it that fast and that clearly? Genius. Genius. Yeah. You like comedy? You like watching comedy more than watching drama?
You know, tough to say. I think I just kind of appreciate both the same way because, you know, like I'm a lover of TCM, so I'll just turn on TCM and see what's
me
on.
Me
so,
too.
Right? Me yeah. So, too. You know, I'll pick up new things I haven't seen before. Like, you know, I can appreciate some Like It Hot just as much as I could appreciate a Peter Bogdanovich film or an Akira Kurosawa or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They all have their places.
No, you just named some people I love. And I'm also a TCM junkie. I mean, any time of day you can turn it on and you're going to see something.
It's always gold. Yeah.
Always. Yeah. I love TCM. I like the old movies. You know, there was a very great actor, Charles Durning, who's passed on now, and character actor. You've seen him in a million things. And his view was, if you want to learn to act, just watch old movies. Watch all the movies from the 30s and 40s that you can and learn from them. Their reality, their expression, their stakes, their clarity. You know, they're not, you know, taking 10 minutes to have a mood move in on them, you know? And I think he's pretty right. You know, he's right on about that.
All right. So Natalia, let's beam into our Star Trek discussion right now. You were Admiral Nechayev across two different Trek series, DS9 and TNG. And it started in TNG's 6 seasons, Chain of Command. Got to ask you, Natalia, had you ever auditioned for Star Trek before season 6?
Yes. And I, was told, I can't remember the exact character, but I was told by my agent that my audition, I was too strong in the audition. I'm trying to remember what the character was, but whatever it was, apparently I hadn't analyzed it properly because I came on too strong and I failed at the audition. And I was very disappointed. I was familiar with the series, clearly, even if I wasn't a complete addict, as I eventually became. So it was sometime later, weeks, maybe months, they called me. And I mean, not me. They called my agent. They said, we have a character, a very strong character. We want that actress to come back in that, you know, apparently I made some kind of impression. And so I got the material and I studied it and I analyzed it and I found the strength of somebody who would be running, who would be an admiral, and coming from a somewhat military family. I mean, I kind of understand some of that. And it was lots of words. My first episode was lots and lots of when I dismiss Captain Picard, I had this long opening where I thought, oh my gosh, you know, how do the regulars do this? You know, that, well, I did my homework, and I really believe in that. You know, actors out there, come prepared for your auditions, and I got it, and I was thrilled. And the first day on the set, you're always a little nervous, you know. And they were welcoming, like Angela Lansbury. They created an environment that was welcoming, and I appreciated that. Jonathan Frakes, fabulous guy, and anyway. So we did a rehearsal of that opening monologue, and I did the rehearsal and we did it all the way through. And I think it was, I don't know, one of the gals, Sirtis maybe, I can't remember which one, said, oh my God, she knows her words. She did that in one take, you know? And I realized that what happens when you're a regular is sometimes you don't have time to learn everything the night before. And so you've got the page under the thing and you're like checking in between takes. But if you're a guest, you want to be perfect, you know? And I really appreciated all the work I put into it because it was, you know, it was recognized and it went great. And I loved dismissing Picard. That was so rewarding, you know, to just say, you know, you're no longer needed. And Jonathan Frakes, we used to joke about how maybe rude Admiral Nechayev was to him. And later on, he directed an episode of DS9 that I was in. And he came up to me and he said, now I can get my revenge for the way you treated my character in Next Generation. But anyway, he's a sweetheart. So yeah, I had auditioned once before. That was your question. And then I got the second one. And I didn't know I would recur. I had no idea. And nor did I have any idea about conventions. It was about 2 years or so or more after I had done the work that somebody came up to me and said, why don't you ever go to conventions? I said, what convention? What are you talking about? They said, well, you know, I said, oh, that's just for the, oh, you mean for the regular, you know, I thought just the regulars. They go, oh no, the regulars don't go nearly as much as the guests go, you know. And my first convention was in Pasadena. And wow, I was amazed at the fans knowing Admiral Nechayev as they did, and also saying, we've been waiting for you to come to a convention. I was like, I had no idea. It was a gift they kept on giving. I had no idea. And I've been to many, many, many since then. But Star Trek was really a diamond in my career. I loved the people. I loved the character. I loved her. She was so principled. And fans would come to me and say, why were you so mean? And I'd say, look, I wasn't mean. I was trying to save the Federation. Hello, how are you? You know, Picard was like, you know, Mr. Softy and humane. And that was important, not soft, but, you know, always taking the humane side, which was important. And I had to represent, you know, the principal that would not, you know, let the Borg get away with anything, for example. And so I'd have to explain that to my fans so they wouldn't hate me. But they go, oh, I never thought of it that way, you know. But of course, everybody's loyalty was allied with Picard, as well it should. I mean, he was the star of the show. So, but yeah, I loved her. I loved Alina Nechayev. And I always write biographies, by the way, of my characters, which I invent based on a little few clues that you get in the script. I don't save all of them. I wish I'd saved them all. But anyway, I don't know if I still have Alina Nechayev's biography, but it helps me to create a background for the character that comes from me, not just from the writer giving it to me, you know, just a tool, just an acting tool that I use.
Hey, everybody, we'll get right back to the interview in 1 second, but I wanted to remind you all to check out Trek Untold over at Patreon. Patreon is the best way to directly support creators of things you like through a monthly subscription of an amount that you can choose. Trek Untold has a few different tiers already with different benefits, ranging from early access to episodes, the ability to ask a future guest questions, exclusive merchandise, and other bonuses that I'd love to offer, but first I need to grow that Patreon community to do that. Trek Untold has been around since mid-2020 and has grown a ton since then, thanks to listeners and viewers like you. Through a platform like Patreon, you can help me keep improving the quality of each episode and keep bringing you new interviews with folks that make the Star Trek universe what it is. If this community can grow more over on Patreon, I can offer new perks like watch parties, exclusive Trek Untold episodes, being able to directly interact with guests, and other things, but in order to do that, I need to know my audience wants these things. The best way to tell me what you want is by supporting us on Patreon, so please, check us out at patreon.com/trekuntold today and become a bigger part of the Trek Untold family. And now, back to the interview.
The interesting thing that I hear a lot about your character is, like you were saying, people think that she's mean to everybody, but it's like she's really not. And I'm kind of curious if you have any insight into this here. Since, you know, the first time we see the character, you know, one of my favorite scenes is Riker looking down at her because she's so much shorter, but really Her presence is so much bigger and so much more commanding. But, you know, that episode, you know, she's very strict. She's very stern. Then, you know, we see her again a few more times in TNG, and now she's drinking tea, sitting down, hanging out with Picard. And I've always wondered, you know, because we see her again in DS9, kind of back to her old ways. We can talk about that later. But as far as TNG goes, I always wondered, like, why she got so much softer. And I'm wondering if that was a choice that was made behind the scenes because maybe there was fan letters saying, why is she so mean? We don't like her. As opposed to them recognizing the fact that, you know, like, you're an authoritative figure. I'm wondering if there's any, like, sexism at play in the era or, you know, any kind of insight you might have into why the character kind of changed a little bit and softened up a little bit.
Well, I don't know if it was any fan letter saying I was too mean or if the producers said, you know, let's explore the relationship between Picard and Nechayev. Because, I fire him. And yes, I dress him down for letting the Borg, you know, get away. And however, taking the Indians off the land, that episode, I always forget the names of them. We're sitting down and it's not the tea party yet, but I understand for the first time you see the character understand his side of the story. And I say, I did try to find another solution, but this is the only way. And it has to be that way. And he's very dour about it. And at that moment I say, if you don't want to do it, I'll take care of it and have somebody else, you know, because I sympathize with the fact that it was just too hard for him to shove them off the, you know, to him, it seemed brutal. And from my stand, it was a necessary thing. And so after that episode, they came up with the tea party with the Valerian canopy. And I thought that was really interesting. He and I had great on-screen chemistry. I mean, we worked
no argument
well.
There.
And he was really the person I had scenes with. I didn't have much with anybody else. Jonathan Frakes would come and go, but it was all me and Picard. And I felt when they created that that tea party of Valerian canopy, and I really thought, wow, this is an opportunity for them to have a relationship of some nature between a tough broad who's superior and, you know, a humane captain. It would be so interesting. And nobody said this to me, but I thought even if it developed into something romantic, you know, or I mean, to what degree that could be expressed, I don't know. But I thought they were really onto something brilliant. I didn't have anything to do with it, but I was sure happy when it showed up. And I was deeply saddened that that was the last season, because I had a feeling, and many people have said that this to me, fans, if it had gone on, we think you and Picard would have, you know, had something. And I think it's a natural thing to assume because they were headed that way. And also from a producer's point of view, which I've never produced film, but I've produced on stage, you don't want a character to be one-dimensional, you know, tough, broad, you know, goes so far. And then it's more interesting if you see, well, she does have a conscience. She knows it was kind of a brutal thing to take the enemies, the not enemy, the Indians off their native turf. But she had to do it, you know. And that's what admiral and higher generals, I guess, and up the ladder have to make those hard decisions. And that's what, when I was doing my homework on it, I thought, you know, I have to join the consciousness of the character who sees this as the bigger good. And it's not always easy to play that, because people want you to be sympathetic, you know. And I played sympathetic characters as well, but not she was, you know, a real challenge that way. But then they did make her more I wouldn't say soft, but just more human and less authoritative. And I thought that was a really smart choice. And it's a shame we didn't go on further.
That's a good way to look at it. She's more relatable as well. She still hasn't lost her authoritative tone. Right. Yeah, she's a lot more relatable now, and fans can get a little more behind her.
Right. You're not going to push her around, but she does. She's a human being. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was very smart on their part. And then, of course, with Sisko, I mean, he was just, you know, disobedient. He didn't want to obey anything, you know, and so we'd have it out. And in the end, I remember the second episode, I think I did. He just has this big tirade, and I'm sitting there, and I just sit and I listen, and I let him go, and he goes on, and he rants and raves. And when it's over, my line to him is, "And you will carry out orders," or something along those lines, you know. And so the authority was still there, and I think people in authority know that sometimes you do have to let people just rip, and they let it out, and in the end, it's still going to be your way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was great too. That was fun, but I was very. I just loved Next Gen. I really loved it. I mean, not just the episodes I was in. I just thought it was so great. Such a great series. The best, I thought.
I mean, you might be a little biased, but you know.
Yeah, I think it might be.
TNG is interesting too, because it has a pretty important cameo in it, and one of them happens in the episode you're in. In the second episode, you're in Descent, which is known for having the Stephen Hawking's cameo.
Yes.
And I don't know if you were there the day that they filmed that or not, or if
I wish
you
weren't. I had been.
Yeah. I mean, did you hear anybody talking about it after it happened?
You know, I don't remember hearing anything, but I, you know, obviously have long had enormous respect and admiration for that man, all that he is. And I wish I had been. That would have been a wonderful, memorable opportunity to meet him. You know, those series that have a long life, they're very smart to have these special cameos, you know, that, you know, nobody's going to forget that, you know, and they can get them, pardon me, because they want to be in something that's successful. We'd have to say that was a successful series. Roddenberry, what a genius. What a prophet. He was a prophet, really.
That's DS9 now. It's different. That's a different series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Star Trek jokes. Oh, me.
Very funny. Okay.
Well, I do want to go from, you know, talk about authoritative admiral to hairstyles of the admiral, because one thing I noticed is your hair changed a few times. I was curious if that was your decision, behind the scenes decisions.
No, not mine. But thank goodness that they did. The
you
first
didn't like the pointy bun
was so well. I think actually, to introduce a tough, authoritative character, it was probably just right, because it looked like every strand was in place and you don't want to mess with her. But in the interest, maybe they didn't know I was going to come back, and maybe they decided to have me back. You know, I don't know if they know there's going to be repeat. They probably wait to see how it works out the first time, you know, before they say, yeah, we're going to recur. And I think, somebody gave them the note that it was too harsh. And so then my hair was pretty blonde then, more than it is now. And my bangs that they used, that was all my blonde hair. And then they added the piece in the back, which matched it. I wasn't, my hair wasn't that long then or ever, but yeah, it was. Somebody came up with an arc for that character after the first episode, and think they realized, oh, this could be interesting, but, you know, let's soften her up a little bit, you know, give her, you know, that second hairstyle was much more approachable.
Yeah.
But I think the first one, it was right to introduce her that way, kind of like the Iron Lady.
It kind of reminded me of like Tippi Hedren from The Birds.
Yeah. Wow, what a good correlation. Yeah, you do know your old movies, don't you?
I try. But yeah, very much that kind of icy blonde, stern. She doesn't care what you think. Mm-hmm. She has to do what she's going to do, and you're in the way.
That's it. Get on the bus or get out of my way. Yeah. That's an old New York expression, actually.
There you go. But we haven't seen Admiral and the Chayev show up in any of the new shows. But I mean, technically, the character is still in the time frame of like Lower Decks and maybe anything new they might be working on. So what do you think, Natalia? Could the Admiral perhaps have one more ride?
I pray. I would so love to have been on Picard, but it didn't happen. But I would. My goodness. I think that this is going to sound self-serving, but I think it'd be wise for them to bring back a character like mine that was so, I mean, even if, you know, they age me or whatever, but that was effective. I'm not going to say I was the most popular in the world. I was, you know, fairly popular, but, you know, there were many others. But I was so effective in that kind of, you know, running the show thing. It would be, I think it would be wise for them to consider that anyway. And God knows I'd love to do it. And yes, it's on my prayer list of things to do. You know, I don't like to call it a bucket list. I call it a prayer list of things I like to be able to go back to. Yeah, it would be fantastic. I've seen Patrick Stewart at a couple of conventions, and we always have a warm connection, and we chat a bit. And he's a wonderful person, really. I mean, just heart of gold.
Well, fingers crossed we get it to happen soon.
Please. Yeah. Thank you.
So, you know, Natalia, as we wrap things up here, I just got a few last lightning round questions for you. I mean, we call them lightning round, but they're not at all. Best day on the job, worst day on the job. And that could be for anything, theater or screen, film, whatever.
Star Trek or?
Anything.
Ooh. Best day. I hate to betray Star Trek, but working with Jack Nicholson in the movie Hoffa as his wife was just absolutely so thrilling. Worst day on the job. I was an understudy on Broadway in a play with William Hurt and Harvey Keitel. And I went on one night and I tripped and fell on the stage. I mean, I got right up and continued, didn't miss a beat with the dialogue, but that was like, I wanted to shoot myself afterwards. But anyway, I'd like to redo that one.
If my audience who is listening or watching today could only watch one thing of you, whether it's, again, on stage or on TV film, what would be that role that you're most proud of that you think best represents you?
I don't know if anybody can access this. It was a TNT series called Lazarus Man, in which I played a double spy during the Civil War, right after the Civil War, who disguised herself as a prostitute. And I had the French accent, but really I was from Georgia. And she was so complicated and it was so brilliant. And I did 6 episodes of it. And then Robert Urich, who was the lead, became ill and TNT canceled it. And he got well and they wouldn't it was cancer. And he got well, he survived and they wouldn't reopen it. And he went on to do another series, God bless him. And then eventually he passed. But I loved her because she was so complicated. That really showed a lot of colors for me.
You know? I'm going to have to do some homework and see if I can find it.
You can find it, but it's hard. You have to. I have some episodes of it, but yeah, I mean, and I'll never forgive Ted Turner for not reigniting it, or at least putting it on one of the, you know, put it out on Netflix or something.
Yeah, something.
You can find it, but you probably have to bootleg it. Yeah, I'll see what I can do for you.
All right. How about something that you know today that you wish you knew when you were younger?
You know, I trust that I get the roles I'm supposed to get, and I'm at the place where I'm supposed to be. When I was younger and I didn't get a role, I would weep. I mean, it was just, or I would be so depressed. And, you know, I don't do that anymore. And I'll tell you a quick story. I was living in LA and I was flown out to New York to audition to substitute, to go into Lost in Yonkers by Neil Simon, and on Broadway. And I'd already been on Broadway, but oh man, did I want to do this play. And I studied and had to have a Bronx accent, and I studied it, and I hired somebody to help me, blah, 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 the whole thing. And I did the audition, and he was in the audience and the director, and I could just tell they weren't responding to me. And I went across the street and to a restaurant and went into the bathroom, and I just wept. I so wanted this part. And I was drama queen. I tore up the script. I threw it away. I was just so upset. I got back to LA, and 3 weeks later, I was cast opposite Jack Nicholson in Hoffa. Now, which did more for my career, to substitute for somebody in a thing or the, and after that, I thought, you know what? I'm going to trust that I am going to be placed at the place where I'm supposed to be. And maybe, I don't know why I was brought out there to audition and not get it. What I'm supposed to learn from that? Well, I learned that, you know, you can't get every part. I did the best I could. And for some reason they choose someone else. I have to trust that that's okay. And I wish I'd known that earlier. In my 20s, I was just a basket case when I didn't get what I wanted. Silly. You know, there's a bigger plan in place than my measly desires, you know. So I don't suffer that way anymore. I can be disappointed, but I don't suffer over it. And I move on. You know, it's like, okay, what's next? Go on to the next thing. It's really important. And for young people, you know, trying out and auditioning and getting rejected, that's just part of the game. That all those rejections are, they evaporate when you get one yes. One yes makes all the no's disappear.
Well, our penultimate question kind of goes hand in hand with that last question here. What's the most valuable lesson that someone taught you, whether that's about life or your profession, that you still think about and use today?
My dad, always be yourself. That's what he told me. Don't put on airs. Don't try to, you know, be something you're not. Be yourself. And I mean, even Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true. But my dad meant it in the sense that, you know, we had humble beginnings, but we were who we were. And there was nothing, there's no reason to put on any airs and try to be something other than who you are. Obviously, when you're acting, you're you're putting on a character, but that's a different thing. He wasn't talking about that. He was, you know, be honest and be yourself. I still think about that. Great words of wisdom from my Normandy invader hero dad.
Yeah. And last thing today, Natalia, what's the best thing about being a part of the Star Trek universe?
Meeting people, meeting all these fans, having conversations with them, learning what a diverse group of people love Star Trek. I mean, from professors to, you know, housewives to young people to, it's so vast. And what I have been privileged to enjoy at conventions, getting to know these people, the military that loves Star Trek, they touch my heart. I end up giving away half my things to them. You know, I'm so in awe and respect for them. It's really a privilege to get to know them. I mean, they come to meet me, but I like getting to know them. And I hope that continues, you know, at the Hop Hog Long yes. Island.
Look at that nice segue. That was good. Yeah, because you're going to be one more time at Trek Long Island 2, Hop Hog. May 31st through June 2nd. How about that?
I can't wait. May 31st through June 2nd. I'm on Long Island and I am going to be meeting more fans and I'm going to get to meet you in person and I'm going to have a great time. I love people, you know.
Have you been working on your Long Island accent?
No, I was hoping you'd give me some tips.
Yeah, I mean, you got to use the trigger word here. It's like Long Island.
The G.
You drag the words a little bit more.
Yeah, Long Island. I'm going to Long Island.
That's good. That's a good start.
I'll go to Jones Beach one day. I don't know. Well, now it's starting to sound Russian.
I was gonna say, now you're a Jewish immigrant living on Long Island, but you're close.
The Polar Bear Club. I guess I better listen to Moonstruck or something to get sort of the New York accent. What do you think?
That'll help. Yeah, I'll get you some homework. You got some time to get ready.
Yeah, give me some homework. I want to blend in with the natives of Long Island. And I'm really looking forward to going back east. I haven't been to New York in a while, and I'm going to dip down into the city at some point.
Okay, well, we're happy to have you back.
Thank you. I'm so grateful, Matthew. This was so enjoyable. And you know, I didn't want to do it for very long. I went, you know, but here we are an hour later and it just flew by as you predicted it would. And you're very good at this. You're very
good at
and getting people to open up and yakety yak. So thank you for that and making me comfortable. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I love your stories. Love hearing everything I talk about. There's so much more we could talk about, but we're going to save that at Trekking Island too. How about that?
Okay, that's a deal. All right. I'll see you then. Thank you, Matthew. Bye-bye for now.
That's it for this week's episode of Trek Untold. Thank you for checking it out. Don't forget to follow us on social media, whether it's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok at Trek Untold, and subscribe wherever you are listening to or watching on. And that includes the audio versions on whatever platforms that might be and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@Trek Untold. If you'd like to support this show financially, please consider visiting patreon.com/trekuntold to become a member of this show. And along with getting access to all sorts of wonderful perks, you'll also know that you're helping out this show continue to thrive, survive, and make new content all the time. I'm Matthew Kaplowitz. This has been Trek Untold. Thanks for watching. And until next time, always remember, fortune favors the bold.
Trek Untold, the Star Trek podcast that goes beyond the stars, is powered by the Rageworks Podcast Network and affiliated with Nerd News Today.